welcome to this smoky edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Eric Dethridge in the hosting chair for Craig Blumenschein today. And hey, if you're in the eastern part of North Dakota or pretty much anywhere in Minnesota, breathing easy has been a bit of a challenge today, right? With all the wildfire smoke pouring in from the Arrowhead region of Minnesota. Yeah, it's been a rough day for people sensitive to poor air quality, for sure. Well, just ahead on the program, we'll learn about some other environmental concerns for North Dakotans. Plus, Craig talks about how North Dakota's gateway to science is transforming how visitors, and especially our future doctors, are learning about anatomy. And you don't have to cut open an animal to do it. But first, it's Craig Blumenschein's weekly deep journalistic dive.
This is a closer look with the monitor. I'm Craig Blumenschein from Prairie Public. Two stories now making headlines at the North Dakota Monitor raise important questions about how state regulators balance economic development, environmental protection, and public interest. First, today we'll examine the legal challenges surrounding the permit for what would become one of North Dakota's largest dairy operations, where opponents argue state regulators fail to adequately evaluate potential environmental impacts. Then we'll turn to an ongoing courtroom dispute over the Summit Carbon Solutions Pipeline, where attorneys debated whether the North Dakota Public Service Commission can even consider public safety when approving pipeline routes. Joining us to dissect both of these issues is Jeff Beach, Deputy Editor of the North Dakota Monitor. Jeff, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Craig.
Jeff, let's begin with this proposed dairy. Give us an overview of the project and why it's become so controversial.
The dairy that the hearing was about is actually called the Herberg Dairy, kind of southeast of Hillsboro, actually not far from the town of Halstead, Minnesota. That one is 25,000 cows is what they are proposing, double the size of the one at Abercrombie, which is a little further along in its construction phase. So the likes of these kinds of dairies have not been seen in North Dakota, which has had, you know, a dwindling dairy cow population over several decades. You know, farms are usually, you know, maybe a couple hundred cows. So the size and scope of these dairy farms is unlike anything North Dakota has seen before. The company that is, planning these dairies is based in Morris, Minnesota, west central Minnesota, really not that far from the Wahpeton site, the Abercrombie site. So they operate several milking operations that include, thousands of cows at the sites that they've been operating.
Opponents recently argued before a judge that the dairy's permit should be reversed. What are the central legal arguments that they're making, Jeff?
So the permit came from the North Dakota Department of Environmental Quality. The opponents, kind of led by the Dakota Resource Council in North Dakota, are basically asserting that the Department of Environmental Quality didn't do a thorough enough job in evaluating some of the potential pollutants that would come from the dairy operation. The dairy does provide a manure management plan. They call it a nutrient management plan. But the attorneys for the Dakota Resource Council pointed to some things that they say, the department should have given further consideration. The proximity to the floodplain, the dairy is not far from the Red River, how drain tile that farmers use to, drain fields more quickly in the spring, to how that might impact runoff from a manure that is spread on fields. So things of that nature that they are saying that the permit process should go back to the DEQ for further scrutiny.
So Jeff, then, are the supporters saying, hey, we've been through the process of DEQ permitting, we've met whatever bars that they've set for us, we should move forward?
Yes. Yeah, so the Department of Environmental Quality, they basically are saying, the DEQ answered all the questions that came through in public comment period. They held a public hearing in Hillsboro, answered questions there. That's actually something they didn't do with the Abercrombie Dairy. There was no public hearing with the Abercrombie Dairy. So, they say they've, examined, the management plan, construction plan, operation plans, their environmental monitoring plan. So DEQ is basically saying our process was thorough.
So what economic benefits are being touted here?
The dairy does create a certain number of jobs, there is actually some housing that's comes along with a dairy of that size because they need people there 24/7. So actually the first things that have been built at the Herbert Dairy in near Halstead are kind of living quarters for people that will work at the dairy. I think the main economic benefit that Trail County would see is another market for farmers to sell corn and other feed products to the dairy, and then in return, farmers, the Riverview Dairy works with farmers to have them spread manure that comes from the dairy onto their farm fields, which potentially reduces the farmer's fertilizer cost. So those kinds of things are of benefit to the local economy. There will be a lot of trucking in and out of that dairy too, and just a general uptick in economic activity around the dairy.
So is this case, Jeff, really about a single dairy here, or could the court's decisions establish broader expectations for environmental reviews of large livestock operations to come?
Yeah, I think it certainly could. If the Dakota Resource Council were to prevail, I think it would put some pressure on the Department of Environmental Quality to do a more comprehensive environmental review for large dairies or other livestock operations. They often are referred to as concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, if you hear that term. So I think it certainly would put some pressure on DEQ to do that. And North Dakota's leadership, the legislature and Department of Agriculture from Doug Burgum when he was governor, he was making growing animal agriculture in North Dakota a priority. North Dakota's kind of fallen behind its neighbors in things like dairy cows and hog production, especially.
What happens next in this particular case, and do we know when we can expect a ruling?
I don't know when we can expect a ruling. That'll be up to Judge Susan Bailey. I would, what I've heard is that it would likely be before the end of the year. I think I would guess that the judge will take probably at least a month. So that's, but really it's up to the judge.
You're listening to A Closer Look with the Monitor. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and I'm visiting with Jeff Beach. He's the deputy editor of the North Dakota Monitor. We've been discussing legal challenges to North Dakota's largest proposed dairy projects. Now, Jeff, let's shift to another courtroom dispute, this one involving the Summit Carbon Solutions Pipeline, and an argument over whether public safety is even something state regulators are allowed to consider when approving the pipeline, though state regulators say it's not. Jeff, this hearing produced a statement that caught many people's attention, that public safety isn't a factor for the Public Service Commission that they can legally consider. So explain what happened.
So there are landowners along the Summit Carbon Solutions Pipeline route, or proposed route in North Dakota, as well as two counties, Emmons County in South Central North Dakota and Burley County, which is Bismarck, where the main trunk of this pipeline would go through both of those counties. Their individual cases have been kind of lumped together into one case, landowners and those two counties together, that are challenging the Public Service Commission's issuance of a permit for the pipeline, the carbon capture pipeline. The public safety aspect of that hearing kind of was really raised by the attorney for the Public Service Commission, Zachary Pelham. So he's the one who kind of raised the idea that the Public Service Commission really is preempted by federal authorities on assessing the safety of a pipeline operation like that. There's a so so it I think it kind of took the judge by surprise. I think it kind of took the other attorneys by surprise. It certainly took me by surprise. So
me too, when I read the story, and it just makes you ask, if the Public Service Commission can't consider pipeline safety, what exactly is its role when they're reviewing a pipeline permit?
Right. So that is kind of the question that the judge asked Zachary Pelham. And, you know, he said that, you know, the Public Service Commission can make sure that things like you know, that safety precautions like, you know, safety valves or shutoff valves are in place, and can ask questions about how they might operate, just to make sure that those things are in place. But he said, really, you know, the Public Service Commission can check for the impact on the public welfare for things such as noise pollution or the appearance of the structure might be going in, and its impact on potential impact on the environment and wildlife and things like state-owned lands. So that was kind of where Mr. Pelham went with his answer.
The hearing also involved discussion that you pointed out, Jeff, of Summit Carbon's dioxide plume dispersion model. What is that, and why has that become an issue in this lawsuit?
That was, has been a topic of discussion all during the hearings leading up to that Public Service Commission decision. And essentially what, I haven't seen it, so I can't exactly tell you what's in it, but Summit Carbon Solutions has developed some sort of model for if there were a rupture, you know, of the pipeline under high pressure, you know, how quickly would the gas escape from the pipeline? Where might it go depending on the weather conditions, depending on the topography? How quickly can the valves get shut off? You know, and assumingly, you know, that they're shut off, that the shutoff valves, you know, what might emergency responders and the public be looking at? And where might that gas end up going? So, you know, carbon dioxide in concentrated amounts is a deadly gas. So that is something that the public asked for, attorneys for these parties asked for, but has never been made public.
Attorneys challenging the permit also questioned alternative routes and local setback requirements. What were those arguments?
So so both Emmons County and Burley County have tried to or set increased the setback distances from a pipeline in their counties. Summit and had basically said the setbacks were so far away from any potential pipeline that you're basically making it impossible for us to route a pipeline through your county. There was also a challenge to whether or not a state setback rules take precedence over those county ordinances, and the Public Service Commission has determined that yes, that is their stance, that rule takes precedence over those local ordinances. But the attorneys for the counties don't feel like that issue is settled quite yet from their arguments yesterday. So that's kind of the setback part of the argument. There was some discussion of an alternative route instead of going kind of around the north side of Bismarck to the carbon storage site. Perhaps there could be a southern route, and attorneys basically said that alternative route was, you know, not given enough discussion, not given enough analysis during the Public Service Commission's deliberations on the permit.
I go back to the safety question. The judge asked, I think, what many listeners are probably wondering: if the Public Service Commission can't regulate safety, then who does? How is that question answered?
Well, there is a through the federal Department of Transportation that they regulate pipelines, especially interstate pipelines. Within the Department of Transportation, there is the Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, also known as PHMSA when people are discussing it. So So the attorney for the North Dakota Public Service Commission basically deferred to PHMSA as the entity that would make sure that the pipeline is constructed of the proper material, buried at a certain depth, has shutoff valves, in regular increments and proper monitoring systems, those kinds of things. So the attorney deferred to on those kinds of what he described as the safety aspect of the pipeline.
Given that Summit has announced plans to pursue carbon storage in Wyoming while continuing to express interest in North Dakota, how does the changing landscape affect the significance of this lawsuit, Jeff?
Well, the Summit's attorneys were still active in this case. They basically followed the argument set out by the Public Service Commission. It could, like the dairy, it could kind of set an interesting precedent one way or the other as far as the scope of the Public Service Commission's authority and, what they might be expected, required, perhaps under the judge's eyes to evaluate when it comes to hazardous materials pipelines.
Jeff Beach is the deputy editor of the North Dakota Monitor. You can read these stories, of course, at the North Dakota Monitor, along with his continuing coverage of state government, the courts, energy, ag, and public policy. All of that is without paywalls or the need to subscribe. Jeff, thanks for helping us understand these important issues, and thanks for being with us on A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thanks for having me, Craig.
Coming up later in the hour, Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson previews what could be the equivalent of property taxes as far as hot-button topics during North Dakota's next legislative session. But up next, a cool new way to learn about anatomy, courtesy of North Dakota's Gateway to Science. I'm Eric Dethridge in the hosting chair for Craig Blumenschein, and you are listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. Support for Prairie Public is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages. And by North Dakota Magazine, formerly North Dakota Horizons. For more than 50 years, the bi-monthly publication has been celebrating North Dakota's great people, places, food, events, and history. Subscriptions available at NorthDakotaMagazine.com.
This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Welcome back. Technology continues to transform the way we learn. And one of the most fascinating tools at the North Dakota Gateway to Science gives visitors an opportunity to explore the human body in remarkable detail. Anatomage is what it's called, and it's becoming a favorite from everyone, from curious kids to even future medical students. Emily Montgomery from the North Dakota Gateway to Science is back with us. Emily, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, Craig?
I'm doing well. All right. We've talked about this before, but tell us again. This is some kind of table.
It is so inspirational and a lot of fun. So our anatomage table, you will find it over in our Science of You area of our exhibits. And it is a long white table that doesn't look like much until you walk up to it. And you recognize that you can actually do surgery without the mess or liability. So you are able to study human and animal anatomy on our anatomage table. It's a digital screen. It's two giant screens that are laid flat, and you're able to show the physiology of the human body. So you can see how the heart beats, how joints move, how muscles contract. And it's just a great tool to create lesson content. Like you said so well, Craig, it can be either for elementary age students. We have our medical students at BSC and UMary that will come specifically with their professors for a lesson utilizing this. And it just inspires young visitors interested in medicine as they consider their future careers, because it's a great way just to dissect things without having to worry about it. And they can utilize how to use a scalpel. They can dissect a cat, a rat, a dog, or a human. So it's pretty great. And we actually just had a 13-year-old visitor recently asking to see the human part of it and just seeing the human brain. And she spent quite a long time for a 13-year-old to be very engaged into it. She did amazing. And just being a woman in STEM, she was so interested in it. And as the gallery staff who does so amazing out there. They were speaking with the girl's grandma, and we found out that her little sister was actually born with a tumor on her trachea and required a lot of medical care during those first 2 years of her life. And she's now doing well, thankfully, but thankfully because of the care she received, and that really inspired her sister to want to become a neonatologist so that she can help other babies like her sister. So it helps solidify for that 13-year-old girl that she loves doing this. So that was a really heartwarming story for us to hear. You never know what people go through walking through our doors. And so giving that chance to just be hands-on.
One of the most surprising aspects of this table is it can work for younger folks or even medical students or even older folks who want to come and learn.
Yeah, absolutely. It can be scaffolded so beautifully to reach all different ages, which is one of my favorite parts of the gallery for sure.
We have to remember that this is not just for people who come to the gallery as students or as people like me who are inquisitive, but educators can build lesson plans around what you offer. Tell me how that works and what makes it such a powerful teaching tool.
Yeah, absolutely. Teachers are more than welcome to. We have different, even if they come to our gallery, our director, Alicia, actually created a really great either scavenger hunt or standards-based worksheets that they can take throughout the gallery. But if they want to use specifically just the anatomage table, they can create a lesson on to align with their human anatomy standards that they have. The anatomage will align with that beautifully. Or younger students who are just learning about how different parts of the body function and move, it's a great way to utilize that. So all of it can have lessons based on it, or they can visit our website to utilize the gallery sheets that we have as well for when they come in to do a tour or visit our gallery.
Certainly true that the North Dakota Gateway to Science is one of our state's crown jewels, Emily, and it's also so refreshing to learn that one exhibit can spark a lifelong dream like you just shared with us. So thank you, Emily Montgomery, for sharing with us again today from the North Dakota Gateway to Science. Emily is a STEM educator there. It's on the banks of the Missouri River, and it's a beautiful place to visit. Thanks, Emily.
Thank you.
It's Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Eric Dethridge in the hosting chair for Craig today. On the way, Dave Thompson and I will discuss all this wildfire smoke that we're dealing with, at least in the eastern part of North Dakota. Fargo's swimming pools and the Red River Zoo have closed early today, for example, and a topic sure to dominate the next legislative session, much like property taxes did during the last one. And up next, George Peck talks about the best way to protect your electronic devices while traveling. Coming up a little bit later in the hour, learn how AI has become a useful tool in the toolbox for some rural teachers. But first, a couple of fun guys who love talking tech.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Glad that you are with us. Whether you're traveling for business or vacation this summer, chances are you may connect with your computer at a hotel, an airport, or coffee shop, or somebody's Wi-Fi at some point. But how safe is that? You really need a VPN, and we're going to tell you what that is here in just a minute if you're not sure. Is Safari more secure than Chrome or Firefox? Is your browser important? And if you're an Apple user, does Apple's emphasis on privacy mean you can skip the VPN altogether? Well, joining us, of course, to unpack all of this is our tech expert, George Peck. George, welcome back to Tech with Peck.
Thank you. I don't know anything about that, so let's talk about something else.
I'm feeling that's not true because I know how much you travel, and I'm sure this has been on your mind whenever you've been out and about at a hotel. So let's start with the basics. What do you do with public Wi-Fi?
So I'll tell you what I do with public Wi-Fi. I don't do a damn thing different. I just get on the public Wi-Fi and I live my life. And
you don't worry about a VPN?
I do not. And the reason is the same reason I think secure sockets layer could potentially be what I would call bogus. All right. So we know that's the little thing that has the little lock in your browser. And when you look at the web address, it's got an HTTPS after it. And the idea of this encrypted internet traffic is that your browser with the lock is communicating to the web server that's sending you the traffic with the lock. And all your traffic is encrypted so that nobody can intercept it. So if we think about that for a second, in order for someone to intercept it, they need to have what's called a packet sniffer or some software or hardware that actually is looking at internet traffic. And as the internet traffic goes flying across the internet or across the network, they can take it and look at it and see what it is. And the argument is, if you do not have your browser encrypted and you type in your password, someone might see that password go flying by and would get your password. I dare you, Craig, to find one case. I don't care. I mean, in the last 20 years, certainly in the last 10, when someone's password or personal information was compromised that way. Each and every case of compromise that we hear about is someone going and stealing a database. And it doesn't matter whether the traffic is encrypted or not encrypted. They steal the database and the passwords are in the database, and that's how they get the passwords. So to me, the whole encryption of internet traffic is potentially a problem looking for a solution. That's my take. Maybe I'm being a little naive. Maybe I'm being a little bit, you know, too, who cares? But when I'm browsing, I'm looking at the Associated Press website and seeing what the president's done today, or I'm looking at YouTube and watching a video on the new OLED TVs from LG. I mean, there's nothing that I'm doing that's particularly secure or important. Now, let's talk about where a VPN came into play and where I do use a VPN.
All right. Let's go there first. VPN, George, stands for Virtual Private Network. Let's tell our listeners what that is.
Virtual Private Network, and we're going to get basic here. When you work for a company in their office, the local area network in a company's office, okay, in the good old days, it was all cable. There was Ethernet cables. Now there's Wi-Fi, but it's still in that building, all right, behind a firewall. And everybody on that network can do what big companies do, which is plot how to destroy their competition, discuss how to price fix, you know, all the things that big companies do without any fear of anybody on the internet finding out, because it's behind the firewall. And if you need to get to the internet to browse the web, the firewall has a little open port that just sends the request to the internet, sends the result back. But your computer and the internal traffic on your LAN local area network stays there.
Your hard drive data, all of that stuff is not accessible. Whatever. To the world.
Okay. What if I want to go to my house where I spend all of my time because I'm a remote worker, or I go on the road? How do I get into that network in that building without the internet catching all the things that I do? Again, if you have a packet sniffer, theoretically, but the answer is a virtual private network. So the virtual private network's original intention was to permit somebody to connect to a local area network in a building from outside that building. So to this day, I've got my network at home, which has, I think now 58 devices. I got one new device last week. All right. And what if I want to connect to that network, for example, from the brewery where I had lunch, if you want me to be honest, where I had lunch today, and maybe turn my Hue lights on and off or do something like that, because I can't do that outside that network. I connect to my virtual private network through my phone or my tablet. That connects me to my network as though I was at home, and I can go ahead and do things as though I was at home. That was the original purpose of the virtual private network. That's what it was for.
You can access your own disk drives that are out there on your own network through the virtual private network, et cetera. People also use this, perhaps nefariously, to change their location.
Well, so now I talked. Now we're getting somewhere, right? So now we talk about, okay, the virtual private networks were typically like Cisco, VP Anywhere, or what it is. Our company uses something called Zscaler, all right? So there are corporate VPNs, and that's their purpose for securing corporate networks and allowing companies with thousands or tens or 20s or 80s of thousands of employees like my company, whose vast majority of workforce is remote, to all collaborate on the same network through the internet without it going anywhere outside of that network. That's the idea of the VPN. So in that case, why, if I Google VPN, do I get a bunch of companies trying to sell a consumer a VPN?
Monthly fees.
Now we're talking.
Subscribe. Here we go.
All right. So here's the reason. I did a little test before we went on the air today. I run an internet radio station, and I have a streaming server inside my network, and it, like every other internet device, can keep track of who's connecting to it. And in particular, it keeps track of something called an IP address. Every device on the internet has an IP address, and they are unique. On the internet, they're all unique. Inside networks, they can be duplicated, but on the internet, everyone has a unique IP address. And if I go to my router, log in, and look at the internet address that my ISP has given me, it's like 135.65.121.42. There, it's all a series of four numbers between 0 and 255. So that IP address is unique. And streaming servers, web servers, everything on the internet keeps track of the IP addresses that connect to it. So I'm getting someplace, believe me, give me time. Okay. This is how I explained it to my wife when we were having lunch at the brewery. All right. I now connected to my internet radio station through two computers in my house. One that was not on a VPN and one that was on a VPN. Now I go to my streaming server and look at current connected clients, and I see two IP addresses. There are tools all over the internet to look up IP addresses because an IP address contains a lot of information about you. It contains, in general, the internet service provider that gave you that IP address, and in most cases, it contains your location. IP addresses have locations attached to them, which is, by the way, how you go to a browser and it says, drivers in Fort Collins are saving money. How does the browser know I'm from Fort Collins? Because you looked at my IP address and there's a location information there. So I look at my streaming server and I have two IP addresses. And one, when I look it up on an IP lookup, says it's the city of Fort Collins. That's who my ISP is. And I am in Fort Collins, Colorado. I look the other one up and it says my ISP is Zscaler and I happen to be in Denver. And that's because it happens to be the Zscaler gateway is in Denver, but it could just as well be in Austin or San Francisco or wherever. So the difference with the VPN is, the VPN, this is a word my wife goes, what does it mean? The VPN obfuscates your real IP address, and that's its primary purpose. It also encrypts your internet traffic so that even if you're not using an SSL browser thing, your traffic is encrypted so that nobody can sniff it. Again, the potential solution looking for a problem. So that's what the consumer level VPN primarily does, is obfuscate your IP address. And that comes in handy for any number of things. All of a sudden, your ad is going to say, drivers in Poughkeepsie are saving money when you're in like Fort Collins, because the IP address you're getting from the VPN server is Poughkeepsie, or it's Ukraine, or whatever you choose. In a lot of cases, the VPN provider you use determines where that IP address says you are. And that comes in handy if you want to watch something in the United States that you normally would not be able to do with the United States IP address, or the other way around. You would be in Iran and you wanted to post, you know, something on a social media site and not have the Iranian government catch you, VPN, and now you got an IP address that's in the United States. So that's one of the benefits of the VPN. What if you're pirating a whole lot of content? Ooh. Okay, so you go to a pirate site and you start downloading things. Well, I don't care what the server is. It keeps track of the IP addresses that are getting files. And if the Motion Picture, you know, Association of America subpoenas that database and sees who downloaded copies of, you know, Project Hail Mary illegally, they can look at an IP address and say they got it, and they can subpoena the internet service provider and find out who that IP address belongs to and sue you. Well, if you've got a VPN that says you're in Ukraine rather than in Fort Collins, it's a lot harder for the MPAA to sue you. So that's also one of the, I'm holding my fingers in quotes, sure, benefits of a VPN. So my take is, generally, consumer level VPNs are designed primarily to let you do bad stuff and get away with it. So there you go.
So I remarked to George, I use Firefox quite a lot, and now there's a button, free, 50 gigs a month, says VPN right in the upper right of my screen. And that hasn't been there before. And it does exactly what George says. It picks a server that's fast, theoretically, but it's not in your location. And it might now say, I am in Salt Lake City rather than in Horace, North Dakota.
So here we go back to the key is that IP addresses keep your location. So we talk about my internet radio station and my provider, the streaming service that I use. I have two servers. One's in my house, but one is a shared service that I purchase. And they have licensing agreements with things like BMI, Broadcast Music Incorporated. I won't give you any more acronyms, but they pay royalties to musicians, which is one of the reasons that I use them for a service, is to keep myself legal, and because I like artists to be paid when their music is played. But they only have agreements with licensing companies in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. They had them with a licensing company in the U.K. The U.K. raised their fees, and the company said, you can't broadcast into the U.K. anymore unless you pay us more, and I didn't do it. So I've had colleagues, because the company I work with is international, listen to my internet radio station, and they try to listen. We're sorry, this broadcast is not available in your country. So geolocating or geofencing is the term. IP addresses include location information. You geofence by saying you only want to have local people be able to watch the local game, and if you're not in the market or the other way around. So you got to get an IP address that gives a different location. That's a VPN application. Now, is it ethical? Yeah. I see those eyebrows going up, dude. Yeah.
And of course, we should think about those things. Now, George, so let's make this come full circle. We kind of wrap up our conversation today. Do travelers need to be less concerned today because pretty much every internet site we work with is an HTTPS site? Is it not a big deal anymore?
That's a good question. So we go way back to the discussion at the very beginning of our segment today. Is that how big is a threat of sniffing internet? Because remember, when you look at every article, every discussion about a password or an ID or a personal information breach, it came from somebody nefariously, there's another great word, getting an ID and a password to a network, going into a database server, and downloading a database with a bunch of personal information. They did not sniff the internet to get it. So the first question is an internet sniff a real threat, which is what VPNs and HTTPS solve? If it is an extra layer of protection, then is the HTTPS on your browser enough? I say yes. So I say nay to a VPN when I'm traveling, unless I need to get on my company's network, because I'm probably too honest of a guy. I don't watch out of market sports. Just if I can't watch it, I don't watch it. I go to the bar. I go to the bar or somebody that's got a license and watch it.
Well, let's hope they do. George Peck is our guest. This is Tech with Peck, our weekly look at technology that shapes our lives. We've been chatting about VPNs, or perhaps not the need for VPNs, browser security, and how to protect our devices and data while traveling. George, thanks for helping us cut through the myths and the realities of staying safe online, and we'll visit again in a week or two.
All right, looking forward to it.
We call Tech with Peck.
All right, Craig. Thanks, man.
I'm Danielle Webster, and every afternoon on All Things Considered, we'll catch up on the day's biggest stories and hear live updates on events and news across North Dakota. We'll also look ahead, previewing the conversations you'll hear on The Daily, hear opinions and ideas from everyday people on The Middle, and give you a first listen at the stories we're following for tomorrow's morning edition. Think of Prairie Public as your afternoon refresher, a place where you can catch up on what happened today, find out about what's happening tonight, and a story to share over breakfast.
Extra, extra, read all about it.
Hear all about it with our esteemed news director, Dave Thompson. We talk to him every Thursday about some of the things he and his team are covering. Dave, pleasure to be talking with you right now.
Thanks, Eric. Pleasure to be talking to you.
Yeah, well, it's a little bit tough breathing out there today. How is the air in Bismarck and points west compared to how it is here in the eastern part?
Now, basically, the smoke was originally forecast just to affect the Grand Forks area. Now it's affecting Fargo, Moorhead, and basically the valley. But if you go, you know, toward Valley City and things like that and go west, then we're not really getting much of the smoke at this point, and we're not expecting to get much of that smoke. They think the smoke is actually going to go toward, you know, the eastern part of the United States. Right now, I was talking to somebody at Department of Environmental Quality in North Dakota, and he said there is smoke reported from basically the Red River Valley to the state of New York.
Yeah, it's crazy. I think mainly because the winds shifted to the northeast because of a front, and that's kind of an unusual wind pattern. You know, normally we get the wildfire smoke in the summer from the northwest, from the Canadian right. wildfires, but this time it's from the northeast.
Plus, there's fires burning in the Boundary Waters area. They have evacuated tourists who are out there doing some canoeing, so they're being evacuated out of that area as well.
A developing story in the Arrowhead region of Minnesota. So obviously, Dave, with smoke and wildfires and how climate change is playing a role, that's kind of top of mind today. But coming up in the next North Dakota legislative session, there's an issue that's likely to move straight to the front burner, as it has around the country. Talk about this new committee and what they're doing ahead of the session.
Right. Now, this was appointed by the Senate Majority Leader. The Senate Majority Leader from Minot said that he's been hearing a lot of talk about data centers and artificial intelligence. So he said, I'm going to put together a special interim study committee to come up with potential legislation for the upcoming legislative session. So they've got a fairly quick timeline to get this done, but they're opening up. They're going to be doing a number of hearings to find out what people are thinking about AI and about these data centers and what needs to be done in order to keep the growth steady, but also to manage any potential spinoff effects.
Transparency, if you're sort of, you know, gauging the winds of the public backlash towards AI and data centers around the country, one of the things that you hear a lot is, we don't like the fact that we don't know who these companies are,
right,
who's behind them, where the money's coming from. There's a lot of discussion about non-disclosure agreements between municipalities and these companies, and voters and just ordinary John Q. citizens feel a little bit left in the dark. So I think that may be a topic that comes up too, is just who are the people that are proposing to build these centers?
Absolutely. And that is one thing that's going to be a major topic of discussion is the NDA. They're going to be talking about where can you allow it and where you shouldn't be able to allow it. So that's going to be one of the things they will be talking about.
Well, North Dakota has always been, let's just say, an energy-friendly state. And mm-hmm. if you compare North Dakota to South Dakota, South Dakota has not quite put out the welcome mat as much as North Dakota has for data centers. Do you sense anything changing in that sort of philosophy?
Not at this point, but I think that will probably be driven by what they uncover in this study. For example, some of the things they've been talked about. Do data centers hum? In some places, I guess they have some kind of electric hum. Two, how are they going to demand and, you know, electricity and power, and how is this going to affect other ratepayers? Well, in North Dakota, some of these co-ops and companies that have data centers have got special high load rates, which won't affect people, homeowners, and that's being fine-tuned as that goes in. So there are a few questions about that. And one they talked about a little bit at the committee, which I was not aware that there are water concerns, that there might be some groundwater issues.
Well, yeah, that's certainly a big concern, water and energy. And I think that we heard from some lawmakers not too long ago that, you know, part of the problem is the public just doesn't get the good information, the correct information about it, that they don't know enough about data centers to have sort of informed opinions on it. So do you think this committee and what's going to be talked about is largely going to be, you know, information sharing with the public?
I think that's going to be a big portion of that, information sharing, and try to get companies to be a bit more transparent.
Well, speaking of artificial intelligence, those who see some of the good things that AI can do will have their hearts warmed by this story. So tell us about rural schools and how they're getting some AI help.
Right. Now, this was called an innovation grant. They received this grant to see how AI could work for young readers, the ones who are just learning to read. And it's being geared toward rural schools because they don't have the teacher population that, say, a Bismarck or Fargo does. But they're hoping that AI will help these students become better readers, understand better what they are reading. And they're hoping that it works. And in a couple of pilot projects in other parts of the country, they've shown some success.
Well, Dave, if we want any relief from the summer heat, some good shade would certainly help. But that's proving to be a bit of a challenge thanks to a little pest that keeps hitching rides into our state. Can you update us on the emerald ash borer, please?
You know, that has been a concern for a long time. They're basically said in North Dakota, do not bring firewood from out of state into North Dakota. Well, apparently it happened because they have found the emerald ash borer in Cass County, in Fargo and north of Mapleton. And an emerald ash borer can wipe out ash trees very quickly. And that's the problem in North Dakota, because the majority of trees in North Dakota are ash trees. So they're really worried about this. If they can contain it, if they can keep the ash borer into just an area, or maybe get rid of it entirely, there are treatments available, but the treatments are kind of expensive.
Yeah, and there's just, you know, not enough trees to begin with in North Dakota.
So that's correct.
Once we have, we certainly want to try and preserve and protect.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Dave, you had a story from Minot about a quote-unquote pig iron? What on earth is that, and what's the connection to Bob Dylan's hometown?
Well, it is Bob Dylan's hometown. They've got mines up there because it's in that, you know, mining area of northern Minnesota. And when they do strip mining for the iron, they have spoil piles. But in the spoil piles, they have found out that there's iron deposits in the spoil piles. So they've come up with technology to ship this to a plant to be built in Minot, and they're going to have the technology they can get the iron out of the spoil piles. And then they can help, you know, what has turned into a shortage of iron for steel. So that's what they're going to be doing in Minot. They're going, you know, rail it from Hibbing, Minnesota, mm-hmm. to Minot, get the impurities out and get the iron out, and then you can ship the iron to like a Pittsburgh or something like that, where they are manufacturing steel. And that will help cut down on the dependence on foreign countries for a lot of the iron.
So that pig iron, is that the final product, or what is that exactly?
It is a fine product. I'm not going to say it's the final product, but it's a very fine product. And pig iron is kind of what it's called, because pig iron is not used alone. It is used in steel.
So you don't think of North Dakota as being kind of a steel part of the country like you do, say, at Pittsburgh. And is that kind of an emerging thing with North Dakota?
Yeah, we're starting to see that emerge. But right now, there wouldn't be a manufacturing plant for steel, because they'll get the iron out of the iron ore, mm-hmm. and then ship it to places where they can manufacture steel. But I will tell you, I've been hearing a little bit of rumbling that if this does work, there might be some steel firms that could come to North Dakota.
Well, Dave, you are anything but a complete unknown, to quote Bob Dylan, in North Dakota. The man, the legend, 45 years plus at Prairie Public and going strong. Dave Thompson, thank you, sir.
Good to do it, Eric. Thank you.
If you're listening to Main Street during the afternoon broadcast on the way, all things considered, Danielle Webster will be your regional host. So how do you translate a nearly 3,000-year-old epic poem to the big screen? Listen to Scott Detrow's conversation with Christopher Nolan, writer and director of the new film The Odyssey. If you're hearing us on the evening broadcast, up next at 8 p.m. Central on The Middle, a conversation with four students at Harvard's Institute of Politics about what's wrong with our political system. So what does the next generation of leaders want to do about it? That's next on The Middle here on Prairie Public.
This is Bird Note. Redwood forests attract millions of visitors every year. Unfortunately, the food left behind by people brings trouble for wildlife. Marbled murrelets are secretive little birds that spend most of their lives at sea, but they breed in the redwoods. Thick, moss-covered branches are like ready-made nests for the murrelet's single egg. After hatching, the chick's speckled down keeps her camouflaged in the canopy, while both parents fetch fish to feed her. Much of the marbled murrelet's historic range has been destroyed by logging and wildfires. And while North America's remaining redwood forests are protected public lands, predators are moving in. Stellar's jays and common ravens are just two opportunists that thrive on our food scraps. And once they've eaten our leftover trail mix, their next meal may be a murrelet egg or chick. The Keep It Crumb Clean campaign is a state park initiative that's educating people about the importance of leaving no food unattended. That means storing food in secure containers, disposing of waste in animal-proof bins, and cleaning up all food, even crumbs. BirdNote has inspired millions of people to take action for birds. Learn more and join us at birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rimmel.
All right, that's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. I'm Eric Dethridge, and for Craig Blumenschein, he will be back with you on Monday. In the meantime, stay hydrated, breathe easy, and enjoy the rest of this day.